The Gloucester Writers Center, the Rocky Neck Cultural Center, Eastern Point Lit House, and Sea Arts all welcome you this afternoon to celebrate and embrace the freedoms of democracy. My name is Joanne Hart, and we are one of more than 100 cities across the country and the world participating in Writers Resist today. Our event here on Rocky Neck was mentioned in the Boston Globe this morning as being one of three in the greater Boston area: Boston, Cambridge, and Gloucester. Writers Resist is the brainchild of PEN America, who recognize that writers have the power to bypass empty political discourse. We have scheduled 20 local authors to read from literature that focuses on the ideals of a free, just, and compassionate society. As time permits, we will then open readings up to the floor. We urge all readers to avoid using the names of politicians or any hate language today. As Martin Luther King wrote, the nonviolent resister not only refuses to shoot his opponent, but he also refuses to hate him. Along the way of life, someone must have sense enough and morality enough to cut off the chain of hate. Henry Farini will begin today's event with a reading of the First Amendment.
Thank you, Joanne. The First Amendment of the United States of America reads, Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof or abridging the freedom of speech or of the press or the right of the people peaceably to assemble and to petition the government for a redress of grievances.
Hi, I'm Karen Ristabin. I'm the president of the Rocky Neck Art Colony, and welcome you all to today. This use of the building is exactly what we had in mind when we purchased the building a few years ago, so thank you all for being here. In January of 1961, as John F. Kennedy's inauguration approached, a colleague suggested that the poet Robert Frost participate in the ceremony as the first inaugural poet. 86-year-old Frost telegrammed Kennedy and said, "If you can bear at your age the honor of being made President of the United States, I ought to be able at my age to bear the honor of taking some part in your inauguration." He proceeded to deliver a beautiful ode to the dream of including the arts in government, which touched Kennedy deeply. 2 years later, after Frost died, Amherst College invited the president to speak at an event honoring the beloved poet. On October 26, 1963, Kennedy took the podium at Amherst and delivered a spectacular speech, mirroring back to Frost that deep dedication to the arts and celebrating the role of the artist in society. Perhaps more than any other public address, it affirmed JFK as that rare species of politician who was equally a poet and prophet of the human spirit. 3 weeks later, JFK was assassinated. But the message at the heart of Kennedy's speech continued to resonate even as his voice was silenced. Less than 2 years later, President Lyndon Johnson signed the National Foundation on the Arts and Humanities Act, creating the National Endowment for the Arts, the very dream that Frost had dreamt up at JFK's inauguration. This was Kennedy's speech. Strength takes many forms, and the most obvious forms are not always the most significant. The men who create power make an indispensable contribution to the nation's greatness, but the men who question power make a contribution just as indispensable, especially when that questioning is disinterested, for they determine whether we use power or power uses us. Robert Frost coupled poetry and power, for he saw poetry as the means of saving power from itself. When power leads men towards arrogance, poetry reminds him of his limitations. When power narrows the areas of man's concern, poetry reminds him of the richness and diversity of his existence. When power corrupts, poetry cleanses. For art establishes the basic human truth which must serve as the touchstone of our judgment. The artist, however faithful to his personal vision of reality, becomes the last champion of the individual mind and sensibility against an intrusive society and an officious state. In pursuing his perceptions of reality, he must often sail against the currents of his time. This is not a popular role. If sometimes our great artists have been the most critical of our society, it is because their sensitivity and their concern for justice, which must motivate any true artist, makes him aware that our nation falls short of its highest potential. I see little of more importance to the future of our country and our civilization than full recognition of the place of the artist. If art is to nourish the roots of our culture, society must set the artist free to follow his vision wherever it takes him. We must never forget that art is not a form of propaganda. It is a form of truth. In free society, art is not a weapon, and it does not belong to the spheres of polemic and ideology. Artists are not engineers of the soul. It may be different elsewhere. But democratic society, in it, the highest duty of the writer, the composer, the artist, is to remain true to himself and to let the chips fall where they may. In serving his vision of the truth, the artist best serves his nation. And the nation which disdains the mission of art invites the fate of Robert Frost's Hired Man, the fate of having nothing to look backward to with pride and nothing to look forward to with hope.
My name is Dorothy Shubo Nelson. I appreciate the writing of American Indian women poets, especially Linda Hogan and Leslie Marmon Silko. There is so much to learn from them and the injunctions that underlie the stories and recognitions. Here are excerpts from Hogan's poem, Trail of Tears, Our Removal. The migration of four tribes, enforced migration of four tribes, took place from 1838 to 1839, and there were at least 4,000 deaths on the trail to Oklahoma. Trail of Tears, Our Removal. With lines unseen, the land was broken. When surveyors came, we knew what the prophet had said was true. This land, with unseen lines, would be taken. So you who live there now, don't forget to love it. Thank it. The place that was once our forest, our ponds, our mosses, the swamplands with birds and more lowly creatures. Have compassion for that land at last. We were once whole, but now our bodies and minds remain the measured geography. I would like to think that my poem about Taos Mountain, written in 2016, emerged from a land-centered consciousness. Here's another of my poems about land and the movement of migrants from Mexico to the U.S. The Return. Ruthless succulents, sparse...
Okay, hold it. That's Karen. Ruthless succulents. That's what we'll pick it up.
Hey.
Come on in, Karen.
Hi, Karen.
Sorry. Here, have a seat.
Yeah,
I scheduled these tight, but
well, this
sorry.
Great.
No. You'll have to hear me. I have to finish.
Okay. No, I can't hear you.
Whenever you're ready, Dorothy.
The Return. Ruthless succulents, sparse acres of palms, oh so delicate ironwoods, doves flapping under the eaves like flags. I know this is America because U.S. flags fly over gated adobe condos, and teachers argue about English only, because Mexicans die trekking in this desert for work as armed Minutemen from 50 states stalk the border, desecrate indigenous lands with ATVs and high-speed chases over fragile terrain. Ohotam people offer water and food to the migrants, hospitals, whatever needs. Others leave gallons of water at remote stations for those making their claims coming home. Mahmoud Darwish, one of the greatest contemporary Arab poets, was widely known and revered throughout the world. Born in 1941, his family fled in 1948 when Israeli forces attacked his village. He published more than 30 volumes of poetry and 8 books of prose and was regarded as Palestine's poet laureate. Children in Palestine recite his poems. He died in August of 2008. Here is one of his poems, an excerpt from one of his poems, A Lover from Palestine. Shelter me in the warmth of your gaze. Take me a panel of almond wood in the cottage of sorrows. Take me a verse from the book of my tragedy. Take me a plaything or a stone from the house so that our next generation may recall the path of return to our home. I would like to imagine that my poem, written in 2008, was inspired by the poetry of Darwish. Truth. You are my half-sister. We have the same father. We have been separated too long. I can stay in this city no more. Tall buildings hide your eyes, the sand in your hair, your wrinkled face. Machines and fighter planes smother your cries and the cries of little birds. Take me to your children. Was it a hard birth? Show me the rose bush near your well, the fruit of your trees, almonds, lemons, figs. Take me to the graves. Walls confine us, keep us estranged. Did you see the half moon low in the sky? I ran to the highway to find the moon. Do you have enough water? Can I reach you with this page? Will this offering call forth water from the dry spring? Call forth absent voices whose lips will kiss stones under stones. Here the rain keeps coming, pushing against the cracks in the frame of my wooden house. There is nothing to do about this rain. Vincent Farini, the son of Italian immigrants, was born in 1913. He became the first poet laureate of Gloucester after publishing 40-plus books of poetry. His poems are imbued with his devotion and concern for the well-being of the community and for humankind as a whole in the face of political opportunism and manipulation. He spoke out often at city council meetings in Gloucester, not unlike Socrates challenging values and actions of the so-called higher-ups in government. He died in 2007. From the Infinite People. In the unlit mornings, I see the bus bound for eternity with its passengers, perpetual strangers. Wake from your twilight sleep. And in your waking and growth in the struggle for bread, you will hear the music of the spirit and you will know one another.
I'm Janet Parsons. I'm the minister at the Gloucester UU Church. And I have two pieces this morning. The first is from researcher Elise Breen, who wanted to share this little story. And that is that Cape Ann has always taken a stand for free speech. In the Civil War era, in 1861, the church in Rockport that was then known as First Universalist Church was smoke-bombed as abolitionist Parker Pillsbury spoke on slavery. All of the other churches had closed their doors to him. His license to preach had been revoked decades earlier. First Universalist had decided to permit him to lecture because of the issue of free speech. The congregation was divided on the issue, and there had been a warning the night before about a possible disturbance. As the people began to flee in a panic, the minister, Mr. Barden, declared that, quote, the question of free speech was before them for decision, that for his part he would stay there till the lecture was over if the church burnt down over his head. And by his well-timed efforts, quiet was restored, and the services were continued till the end. And next, I would like to present Maya Angelou's beloved poem, Still I Rise. You may write me down in history with your bitter, twisted lies. You may tread me in the very dirt, but still, like dust, I'll rise. Does my sassiness upset you? Why are you beset by gloom? 'Cause I walk like I've got oil wells pumping in my living room. Just like moons and like suns, with the certainty of tides, just like hopes springing high, still I'll rise. Did you want to see me broken? Bowed head and lowered eyes? Shoulders falling down like teardrops, weakened by my soulful cries. Does my haughtiness offend you? Don't you take it awful hard? 'Cause I laugh like I've got gold mines digging in my own backyard. You may shoot me with your words. You may cut me with your eyes. You may kill me with your hatefulness. But still, like air, I'll rise. Does my sexiness upset you? Does it come as a surprise that I dance like I've got diamonds at the meeting of my thighs? Out of the huts of history's shame, I rise. Up from a past that's rooted in pain, I rise. I'm a black ocean, leaping and wide, welling and swelling, I bear in the tide. Leaving behind nights of terror and fear, I rise. Into a daybreak that's wonderfully clear, I rise. Bringing the gifts that my ancestors gave, I am the dream and the hope of the slave. I rise, I rise, I rise.
Peter Anastas. I'm going to be reading from one of Henry David Thoreau's less known but most powerful essays, Slavery in Massachusetts, a nice follow-up to the previous reader. Prompted by the affair of the fugitive slave Anthony Burns, who, with the collusion of Boston officials and President Franklin Pierce, was imprisoned and remanded to Virginia, though Massachusetts was then considered a free state. This was delivered as a protest lecture in Framingham on July 4, 1854, and later published in William Lloyd Garrison's abolitionist newspaper, The Liberator, on July 21st of that year. As we consider the questions of freedom of expression and resistance to illegitimate authority, it is important to look back on the abolitionist movement, of which Emerson and Thoreau were members. In particular, the way abolitionists, in their unending battle to end the abomination of chattel slavery, fused political action with a moral imperative. Thoreau, like his mentor Emerson, was a master of the aphoristic sentence. Rather than sharing extended passages from this essay, I'd like to read some of the sentences themselves, whose resonance is all the more powerful if savored separately. And you must forgive retrospectively Thoreau's use of the word men to mean our male and female collectivity. The law will never make men free. It is men who have got to make the law free. There are lovers of law and order. They are lovers of law and order who observe the law when the government breaks it. We are not a religious people, but we are a nation of politicians. We do not care for the Bible, but we do care for the newspaper. I need not say what match I would touch, what system endeavor to blow up. But as I love my life, I would side with the light and let the dark earth roll from under me. Those who think that Thoreau was merely the hermit of Walden Pond have got something very interesting in store when you begin to read essays like this. Will mankind never learn that policy is not morality? That it never secures any moral right, but considers merely what is expedient? What is wanted is men, not of policy, but of probity, who recognize a higher law than the Constitution or the decision of the majority. The fate of the country does not depend on how you vote at the polls. The worst man is as strong as the best at that game. It does not depend on what kind of paper you drop into the ballot box once a year, but on what kind of person you drop from your chamber into the street every morning. The effect of good government is to make life more valuable, of a bad one, to make it less valuable. I am surprised to see men going about their business as if nothing had happened. I say to myself, unfortunates, they have not heard the news. And what is the news? Art is as long as ever, but life is more interrupted and less available for a person's proper pursuits. We have used up all our inherited freedom. If we would save our lives, we must fight for them. And finally, my thoughts are murder to the state and involuntarily go plotting against it. Thank you.
I'm Charlotte Gordon, and I'm with Greg. I love this idea of, I forget the preaching part, being in the choir. And I've been thinking a lot. I mean, I think many of us as writers spend a ton of time alone, and at least I do. And so it's so fabulous to be with people that I'm going to assume that we're all like-minded, and just don't tell me afterwards, you know, if you don't agree with me, because it's lovely. And I've been thinking a lot about how scary it is to take a stand and how scary it is to be attacked for those stands. I recently wrote a book about Mary Wollstonecraft, who wrote a book called A Vindication of the Rights of Woman, and she's the first woman to make such a radical declaration. And as opposed to being, you know, really proud and happy about being the first, she suffered tremendously from suicidal depression, tried to kill herself twice. When I give readings, sometimes people say to me, how could Mary Wollstonecraft have been so depressed? I'm like, are you kidding me? How could she not have been depressed? She was called a whore. She was called, I'm not going to list all the horrible things that she was called. But right up through almost to the 20th century, if you looked up the word whore in the dictionary in England, it said, see Mary Wollstonecraft as an example. I looked for passages from Wollstonecraft, but, you know, she does write in 18th century language, so I'm gonna read you one of my interpretations of what she must have been like. When one opens A Vindication of the Rights of Woman, Mary Wollstonecraft strides right onto the stage, her voice clear and sharp. She's funny, quick, and irritable. as she must have been in person, but she's also rigorously logical, giving the rights of woman a virtuoso flair, like a Socratic dialogue. Mary appealed to readers' emotions because she said, "I think my book is essential for the future of humanity because it outlined the evils of the present state of the oppression of women and introduced solutions that would redeem men as well as women." Yes, men. From first page to last, Mary Wollstonecraft emphasized that women's liberty should matter to everyone. In fact, she wrote Rights of Woman for readers who were learned and well-versed in political theory, and in 1791, that usually meant men, not women. Using what she called strength of mind, Mary promised to reveal exactly what human beings need to be. She said, "For all those men who believe that women are incapable of learning, who are incapable of having an education, what nonsense." But hers was a lone voice. Feminine deficiency was an assumption in the 18th century. Most people did not think to question. Fire was hot, water was wet, women were foolish and weak. Even more pernicious, as Mary saw it, women bragged about such frailty, regarding weakness as an asset. If a female fainted easily, could not abide spiders, feared thunderstorms, ghosts, and highwaymen, ate only tiny portions, collapsed after a brief walk, and wept when she had to add a column of numbers, she was considered the feminine ideal. Mary scorned the idea that being delicate made a woman more attractive. Women had been trained to be empty-headed, she declared. They were not intrinsically less reasonable than men, nor were they lacking in moral fiber. To Mary, the greatest tragedy of all was that neither men nor women saw anything wrong with their culture's assumptions about femininity. Progress required a dramatic change, she thought, in how both sexes imagined themselves and their world. A revolution in female manners, cried Mary, would reform the world. Thank you.
Hi, good afternoon. I'm MJ Boylan. I unfortunately didn't get the memo about not mentioning names and things. And the piece that I had chosen was one by Dan Gilmore, a speech he gave in November. He's a journalist and a journalism teacher. And it was to his fellow journalists in Catalonia. He gave this speech in Barcelona. And it was kind of a clarion call and a beautiful speech. And I encourage you to look it up because I'm really not going to read it. I can't. I'm going to kind of clip it down to some of the conclusions and encourage you to see the thing in its entirety because it is a brilliant speech. What he was doing was expressing, I think, the frustration that many of us had during the election. With journalists, people were shouting at their televisions. They were demanding tougher questions. They were demanding the truth, and they weren't getting it. So picking up right in the middle or toward the end, no other candidate in recent memory understood journalism's flaws and blind spots, and he took total advantage of the opening. He relied on journalists to stick with their insane system of false balance, which often takes the form of giving relatively equal weight to both truth and lies in the name of so-called fairness. Journalists have to recognize that on some issues, they have to become activists. There is no alternative. Even journalists who worship objectivity should recognize that on some issues they cannot possibly be objective. They are obliged to take a side, the side of the truth. I'd argue that freedom of speech is only one of the issues where journalists who do not take an activist stand aren't doing their jobs. These issues come under larger topics at the core of our liberty. Among them, freedom of expression in general, freedom to associate, freedom to collaborate, freedom to innovate. And journalists need to be spreading the concept of media literacy to everyone who will listen. This is, above all, developing skills for critical thinking, being skeptical, using judgment, asking questions, ranging widely for information, and more. People need refuge from the misinformation and a context to understand what is really going on. Core freedoms of expression, association, and more should be everyone's right. And media literacy is everyone's duty. Journalists and journalism educators have a duty to be their active defenders and explainers. Otherwise, we'll live in a world of choke points and control by others. Otherwise, we'll live in a world where lies are as plausible as truth because the public doesn't know how to tell the difference. We have to defend ourselves and our societies from these anti-freedom trends. We have to take stands. It is part of our job now. Again, I'm deeply honored to be here with you. What you do matters so very much. Journalism matters. Thank you.
Hi, I'm Sage Walcott. I'm going to read a short scene from Antigone. And for those of you who may have forgotten it or don't know it, I'm giving you a real brief outline of what was going on here. Basically, it was a civil war. And Antigone's two brothers, who were fighting on opposite sides, were both killed. And King Creon gave the son that was fighting on his side an honorable burial, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But he refused to let the son on the bad side have any kind of a service or a burial or anything. This upset Antigone, who was the sister of both of the brothers. And so this, I'll read you a couple of brief, well, a brief passage from it. It opens with Creon saying to Antigone, "Explain something to me without elaborating. Were you aware of my decree forbidding this?" Antigone, "Of course I knew. We all knew." Creon, "And still you dared to violate the law?" Antigone, "I did. It wasn't Zeus who issued me this order. And justice, who lives below, was not involved. They'd never condone it. I deny that your edicts, since you, a mere man, impose them, have the force to trample on the gods' unwritten and infallible laws. Their laws are not ephemeral. They weren't made yesterday, and they will last forever. No man knows how far back in time they go. I'd never let any man's arrogance bully me into breaking the gods' laws. I'll die someday. How could I not know that? I knew it without your proclamation. If I do die young, that's an advantage. For doesn't a person like me, who lives besieged by trouble, escape by dying? My own death isn't going to bother me, but I would be devastated to see my mother's son die and rot unburied. I've no regrets for what I've done, and if you consider my acts foolhardy, I say, look at the fool charging me with folly.
I am Amanda Cook. Long before I was reading Words of Resistance, I was listening to Songs of Resistance. And I learned this song in the kitchen with my mother years ago from a Pete Seeger album, his We Shall Overcome album. There are no lines in it that feel less relevant when I learned them now than they did when I learned them. And if you'll forgive me, I can't read it. I have to sing it. And I hope one of my favorite sounds is on that album and in life is voices rising together. So when you know the words, sing them, please. You'll have to forgive me also. This is nerve-wracking. Where have you been, my blue-eyed son? Where have you been, my darling young one? I've stumbled on the side of 12 misty mountains. I've walked and I've crawled on 6 crooked highways. I've stepped in the middle of 7 sad forests. I've been out in front of a dozen dead oceans. Been 10,000 miles in the mouth of a graveyard. It's hard, 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 hard. It's a hard rain. It's gonna fall. What did you see, my blue-eyed son? What did you see, my darling young one? I saw a newborn babe with the wild wolves around it. I saw a highway of diamonds with nobody on it. I saw a black branch with the blood that kept dripping. Saw a room full of men with their hammers a-bleeding. Saw a white ladder all covered with water. Saw 10,000 talkers whose tongues were all broken. Saw guns and sharp swords in the hands of young children. It's a hard, 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 it's a hard rain, it's gonna fall. What did you hear, my blue-eyed son? What did you hear, my darling young one? I heard the sound of a thunder, it roared out a warning. Heard the roar of a wave that could drown the whole world. Heard 100 drummers whose hands were ablazing. Heard 10,000 whispering and nobody listening. Heard one person starve, I heard many people laughing. Heard the song of a poet who died in the gutter. Heard the sound of a clown who cried in the alley. It's a hard, 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 hard. It's a hard rain, it's gonna fall. Who did you meet, my blue-eyed son? Who did you meet, my darling young one? I met a young child beside a dead pony. I met a white man who walked a black dog. I met a young woman whose body was burning. I met a young girl, she gave me a rainbow. I met one man who was wounded in love. I met another man who was wounded in hatred, and it's hard, 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 hard. It's a hard rain, it's gonna fall. What do you do now, my blue-eyed son? What do you do now, my darling young one? I'm going back out for the rain starts a-falling. I'll walk to the depths of the deepest black forest, where the people are many and their hands are all empty, where the pellets of poison are flooding the waters, where the home in the valley meets the damp, dirty prison, where the executioner's face is always well hidden, where hunger is ugly, where souls are forgotten, where black is the color, where none is the number. And I'll tell it and think it and speak it and breathe it and reflect it from the mountain so all souls can see it. Then I'll stand on the ocean until I start sinking. But I'll know my song well before I start singing. It's a hard, 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 hard. It's a hard rain. It's gonna fall. Thank you.
I can't top that. So, I'm not even going to try. I'm Chris Anderson. I'm with Eastern Point Lit House. It's really such a gift to be here with you guys today. I have three poems. You know, poetry, literature, it's all an act of empathy, and it's about understanding the other and shining a light. So just three different poems of three different authors. I am not a poet, so I'll try not to murder these. The first is by Jameson Fitzpatrick, and it's called I Woke Up, and it was political. I made coffee, and the coffee was political. I took a shower, and the water was. I walked down the street in short shorts and a Bob Miser tank top, and they were political. The walking and the shorts and the beefcake silk screen of the man posing in a G-string. I forgot my sunglasses, and later, on the train, that was political. When I studied every handsome man in the car, who I thought was handsome was political. I went to work at the university, and everything was very obviously political, the department and the institution. All the cigarettes I smoked between classes were political. Where I threw them when I was through. I was blonde and it was political. So was the difference between blonde and blonde with an E. I had long hair and it was political. I shaved my head and it was. That I didn't know how to grieve when another person was killed in America was political. And it was political when America killed another person, who they were and what color and gender and who I am in relation. I couldn't think about it for too long without feeling helplessness, like childhood. I was a child and it was political being a boy who hadn't had, who was bad at it. I couldn't catch and so the ball became political. My mother read to me almost every night, and the conditions that enabled her to do so were political. That my father's money was new was political. That it was proving something, Someone called me faggot, and it was political. I called myself faggot, and it was political. How difficult my life felt relative to how difficult it was political. I thought I could become a writer, and it was political that I could imagine it. I thought I was not a political poet, and still my imagination was political. It had been. This whole time, I was asleep. And next is a poem by Ross Gay. If you guys don't know Ross and his work, it's phenomenal. This is a small, needful fact. Is that Eric Garner worked for some time for the Parks and Rec, Horticultural Department, which means, perhaps, that with his very large hands, perhaps, in all likelihood, he put gently into the earth some plants which, most likely, some of them, in all likelihood, continue to grow, continue to do what such plants do, like house and feed small and necessary creatures, like being pleasant to touch and smell, like converting sunlight into food, like making it easier for us to breathe. And one more on a lighter note, because this is also something we're going to need to think about. This is by my friend Jen Monroe. This is just one of my favorite poems. It's called Love for Oil. Imagine if love filled the Gulf of Mexico, gushed from a love well deep underneath the ocean floor, thick, fast, unobstructed. Imagine slicks of love, pelicans covered in love, plumes of love, droplets on a collision course with pristine panhandle beaches, or caught up in hurricanes and crashed into seaside communities up and down the East Coast. Imagine a love spill, irreparable. Children up to their ankles at low tide, then up to their waists, their chins. Media reports of failed efforts to recover the love on tankers, to contain it. Imagine the mess we'd be in then. Thank you.
Hello.
All right, there we go. Well, it's all. I'm Brian King, and this has been really inspiring and like a bomb, as they say, maybe protective bomb, hopefully. This is an excerpt from a speech by Angela Davis that she gave in Paris in 1991, and I think it's sort of interesting because she's reflecting about the U.S. in 1970 and about a French writer. So I'll just start. When Jean Genet came to the USA in spring of 1970, although it was our first meeting with him, there were many of us black Americans who already considered him an ally because of his play The Blacks that had shown in New York a few years before. The Black Panther Party invited Genet so he could help them, holding conferences in different universities over the USA. It was a major critical stage of the black, it was a major critical stage of the black, of the struggle in the USA. I was in charge of translating his speeches, for instance, at UCLA, where I was teaching philosophy. A party was arranged for him in the house of a filmmaker, Dalton Trumbo, in Hollywood. Many stars showed up, and it helped raise funds to pay the imprisoned Panthers lawyers, David Hilliard, a member of the Black Panther Party, largely mentioned in The Prisoner of Love, told me Genet had arrived with worn-out clothes and was asked to get a bit dressed up. So he was taken to a San Francisco shop run by a black man, so moved that Genet came to the USA to help the Panthers. He offered him a jacket, a pair of trousers, and a shirt. I remember him so happy to wear those gifts, and me so excited to meet him. I knew his writings. He was a mythical character to me, but face to face with him, I had almost a motherly feeling. He was like a little boy, very kind and laughing a lot. At the time he gave his speeches, the situation was quite complicated. There were not many white folks willing to support an organization very wrongly described as a terrorist one, made up of people willing to kill policemen, etc. At the time, I was a member of this movement and had lost my job as a teacher at UCLA, but I quashed the decision on an appeal and was reintegrated. It was very difficult to succeed in spreading out the movement and find support for black political prisoners. On the campus, teachers and students alike would often demonstrate against the war in Vietnam. For instance, there had been a demonstration against Nixon's policy in Vietnam with 10 to 15,000 persons. Nevertheless, 2 weeks later, when we tried to arrange another demonstration to obtain the release of Bobby Seale, Erica Huggins, and the Soledad brothers, George Jackson, John Clutchett, and Fleeta Drungo, who were in jail, we only managed to gather 200 persons, most of them black. We just didn't succeed raising a great multicultural movement and thought Genet, thanks to his fame, could help us reach white progressives. When we advertised for his conference, the posters did not mention that Genet would talk about the Black Panthers. We just said he would speak, and a huge crowd came to hear him because he was Jean Genet, the great writer. He started saying he would talk about the Black Panthers and made a very moving appeal, a very theoretically advanced one, I'd say, about how to fight racism. Genet had made some proposals 20 years before that we just started to develop. For instance, the white participation in the struggle against racism. After a quarter of an hour, many members of the audience started to get upset and to whisper, and suddenly someone even interrupted Genet, asking him to speak at last of himself and his work. Genet answered, "No, I'm not here to talk about my literature or my books. I came to defend the Black Panther Party." Then something deeply shocking to me occurred. Half the audience progressively left the place. They didn't want to hear about the BBP. For us, it was a real lesson. We could judge how much work had to be done to generate a real movement against racism. Many teachers I was familiar with were unable to attend such debates because, in a way, they felt Genet was accusing them of collusion. However, those who did stay were giving us something invaluable. Genet knew how to speak his heart without pity or condescension. Now we have learned how not to mistake solidarity feelings for feelings of pity among the representatives of the ruling culture. Genet, he had already known how to distinguish them. In his Yale speech, on the May Day speech, he even goes so far as to advocate the development of a tactfulness of the heart when dealing with black folks. He also says that blacks had silently been observing whites for centuries and had learned a lot about them and their cultural background, and whites did not even realize they were being observed. What we had, what we develop nowadays in our lectures means the same. White folks have to go to black school. They have to learn something from them, from black folks, but also Indians, Chicanos, and the whole multicultural U.S. population. One last important point. It was Janae who heightened the Black Panthers, Black Panther Party awareness of the homosexual rights issue. David Hilliard told me that when they were traveling together from state to state, from one university to another, some members of the party were using very rude and homophobic words to insult Nixon or Mitchell. Janae was hurt by these words and told them they should not use such vocabulary. One night, he even showed up at the hotel. There used to be four or five men per room during these trips. So Janae was dressed in a sort of pink negligee and a cigar in his mouth. Well, they all thought Janae was crazy. He had just wanted to bring about a discussion on the similarities between the struggle against racism and the struggle against homophobia. After these trips in 1970, David Hilliard and his mates largely spoke of the matter with Huey Newton, the BBP's president in jail at the time, and later published, soon after, an important article in the BBP's newspaper saying, "Whatever your personal opinions and your insecurities about homosexuality and the various liberation movements among homosexuals and women," Janae also had spoke about women's liberation during his stay, "we should try to unite with them in a revolutionary fashion. I say, whatever your insecurities are, because as we well know, sometimes our first instinct is to want to hit a homosexual in the mouth and want a woman to be quiet. We want to hit a homosexual in the mouth because we are afraid that we might be homosexual. And we want to hit the woman or shut her up because we are afraid that she might castrate us or take the nuts that we might not have to start with. Remember, we have not established a revolutionary value system. We are only in the process of establishing it. I do not remember our ever constituting any value that said that a revolutionary must say offensive things towards homosexuals, or that a revolutionary should make sure that women do not speak about their particular kind of oppression. And I know through reading and through my life experience and observations that homosexuals are not given freedom and liberty by anyone in the society. They might be the most oppressed people in the society." Angela Davis, 1991. So, thank you.
Phoebe Potts, and I'm going to be reading from Ta-Nehisi Coates' book, Between the World and Me, which Ta-Nehisi Coates is African American and writer, and this is a letter to his son. He's just described a story to his son that his son may not remember. His son was very little. They were at the movie theater, and a white woman pushed his son, and he snarled at the white woman, the father, Ta-Nehisi Coates snarled, and a white man shouted this back. "I could have you arrested," he said. Which is to say, one of your son's earliest memories will be watching the men who sodomized Abner Louima and choked Anthony Baez, cuff, club, tase, and break you. I had forgotten the rules. An error as dangerous on the Upper West Side of Manhattan as on the West Side of Baltimore. One must be without error here. Walk in single file. Work quietly. Pack an extra number two pencil. Make no mistakes. But you are human, and you will make mistakes. You will misjudge. You will yell. You will drink too much. You will hang out with people you shouldn't. Not all of us can always be Jackie Robinson. Not even Jackie Robinson was always Jackie Robinson. But the price of error is higher for you than it is for your countrymen. And so that America might justify itself, the story of a black body's destruction must always begin with his or her error, real or imagined, with Eric Garner's anger, with Trayvon Martin's mythical words, "You're gonna die tonight," with Sean Bell's mistake of running with the wrong crowd, with me standing too close to the small-eyed boy pulling out. A society almost necessarily begins every success story with the chapter that most advantages itself. And in America, these precipitating chapters are almost always rendered as the singular action of exceptional individuals. It only takes one person to make a change, you are often told. This is also a myth. Perhaps one person can make a change, but not the kind of change that would raise your body to equality with your countrymen. The import of history is all around us, though very few people like to think about it. Had I informed this woman that when she pushed my son, she was acting according to a tradition that held black bodies as lesser, her response would likely have been, "I'm not a racist," or maybe not. But my experience in this world has been that the people who believe themselves to be white are obsessed with the politics of personal exoneration. And the word racist to them conjures, if not a tobacco-spitting oaf, then something just as fantastic, an orc, troll, or gorgon. "I'm not a racist," an entertainer once insisted after being filmed repeatedly yelling at a heckler. "He's a nigger, he's a nigger." Considering segregationist Senator Strom Thurmond, Richard Nixon concluded, "Strom is no racist." There are no racists in America, or at least none that the people who need to be white know personally. In the era of mass lynching, it was so difficult to find who specifically served as executioner that such deaths were often reported by the press as having happened, quote, "at the hands of persons unknown," quote. In 1957, the white residents of Levittown, Pennsylvania, argued for their right to keep their town segregated. "As moral, religious, and law-abiding citizens," the group wrote, "we feel that we are unprejudiced and undiscriminating in our wish to keep our community a closed community." This was an attempt to commit a shameful act while escaping all sanction, and I raise it to show you that there was no golden era when evildoers did their business and loudly proclaimed it as such. We would prefer to say that such people cannot exist, that there aren't any, writes Solzhenitsyn. To do evil, a human must first of all believe that what he's doing is good, or else that it's a well-considered act in conformity with natural law. This is the foundation of the dream. This is not Martin Luther King's dream, just to be clear. Its adherents must not just believe in it, but believe that it is just. Believe that their possession of the dream is the natural result of grit, honor, and good works. There is some passing acknowledgement of the bad old days, which, by the way, were not so bad as to have any ongoing effect on our present. The metal that it takes to look away from the horror of our prison system, from police forces transformed into armies, from the long war against the black body, is not forged overnight. This is the practice habit of jabbing out one's eyes and forgetting the work of one's hands. To acknowledge these horrors means turning away from the brightly rendered vision of your country, as it has always declared itself, and turning towards something murkier and unknown. It is still too difficult for most Americans to do this, but that is your work. It must be, if only to preserve the sanctity of your mind.
I proudly wear grace. Oh, I am not tall, but I am loud. I proudly wear Grace Murray's 300 goose cold cap. And I am Duncan Nelson. I have 3-1, but I swear my song will be long ere done ere I hear Joanne's gong. So when I say three, first is me, and then we have Thomas Hardy, and then we have Robert Frost. I think I might as well get myself out of the way first. This is written this morning. We need to employ free speech in a high sense, for it can destroy when it becomes license. License to recklessly show us its genus, side and slide down to endorse deeds most heinous. We've seen what's let loose through an open mic can produce rants like that of the Third Reich. Seeing such freedom, such Freitag, pushed to a fault, brought Treblinka, Belsen, Dachau, Buchenwald. Yea, free speech will only find its full force when we come to temper, not dull, our discourse, with a sense no final good will be done for the world till the world works for everyone. Until we turn the key to a prison called our preconceptions and learn to listen. To listen to each and every other as we would to beloved sister or brother. So let's let that be the freedom we reach for today as we speak out for free speech. So true. Listen. Listen to everybody. So now there's for a glimmer of light, we have Hardy, and then there's a glow of light with Frost. I leant upon a coppice gate when frost was spectre gray, and winter's dregs made desolate the weakening eye of day. The tangled vine stems scored the sky like strings of broken lyres, and all mankind that haunted nigh had sought their household fires. The land's sharp features seemed to be the century's corpse outlent. Its crypt a cloudy canopy, the wind its death lament. I'm going to get the best time. Where's the best time? Ah, yes. The ancient seed of germ and birth was shrunken, hard and dry, and every spirit upon earth seemed fervorless as I. At once a voice arose among the bleak twigs overhead, in a full-hearted evensong of joy illimited. A darkling thrush, frail, gaunt, and small, in blast-beruffled plume, had chosen thus to fling its soul upon the growing gloom. So little call for caroling of such ecstatic sound was written upon terrestrial things afar or nigh around, that I could think that there came through his happy midnight song some blessed hope of which he knew. And I, his happy midnight air, some blessed hope whereof he knew, and I was unaware. I love Hardy. Frost. Choose something like a star. O star, the fairest one in sight, we grant your loftiness the right. To some obscurity of cloud, it will not do to say of night, for dark what is what brings out your light. Some mystery becomes the proud, but to be wholly taciturn in your reserve is not allowed. Say something to us we can learn by heart, and when alone, repeat, say something, and it says, I burn. But say with what degree of heat, talk Fahrenheit, talk centigrade, use language we can comprehend. Tell us what elements you blend. It gives us strangely little aid, but does tell something in the end. And steadfast as Keats' Eremite, it not even stooping from its sphere, it asks of us a certain height. So when at times the mob is swayed to carry praise or blame too far, we may choose something like a star to stay our minds on and be stay. Thank you.
I'm Ray Francoeur, thrilled to be here. Okay, thank you. Being a practical person, I offer up a 5-minute and 20-second primer called Rules of Engagement. Now's a good time for a refresher on defiance, making change and finding new and novel ways for people to dislike you. I'm speaking here of community activism, the bedrock of our democracy. If you master these 5 rules of change, you can go on to challenge any lawmaker, Vladimir Putin, or your partner who's driving you crazy with ultimatums about Fritos in bed. Rule one, pick a cause that really riles you. You will live with this issue for a while, so if your passion gauge doesn't spin off into the red zone, skip it. Ask yourself, have I lost too much sleep over this? Have I ruined one too many dinner parties with my rants? Is this why I'm stuffing my face with Fritos? Case study. The November to April parking ban that turns Rockport into a ghost town doesn't make sense. For ease of snow removal, we weren't allowed to park our cars on the street overnight, even when there's no snow. I couldn't get off my high horse about the illogic of this ancient bylaw, so I decided to do something. Rule number two, find cohorts. You can ignite a cause, but you need others to move forward. Case study, I took my parking amendment to Rockport's annual town meeting. My support group consisted of two friends and two family members. Four selectmen spoke in opposition, one in favor. The chairman accused me of lying, which reminds me, activism is really painful. The subsequent martini felt justified. Rule three, put it in writing. Write your cause on top of a piece of paper. Keep it short and persuasive. Draw 25 lines underneath it. Make several copies. Go get a slew of signatures. Case study. My family and I ferried our petition around town. We canvassed, talked, and lobbied. We kept it up for weeks. 100 zealous advocates signed on. One dissenter admonished me for buying a house without a parking space. Another dissenter abstained, fearing retribution. Rule four, agitate. You cannot win if you don't state your case with unflinching candor and irritating frequency. Case study. In year two, we got a parking committee task force. They nominated me for taker of minutes. I said, no, thank you. I have to be free to agitate. Fair warning. I argued with my opponents, the police chief, the fire chief, the head of DPW, the very people I would normally want on my side. The hardest thing I do as an activist is stand my ground. Rule five, don't gloat. Have faith because persistence pays off. Be gracious for whatever baby steps you make, but never back off a victory or give an inch in the aftermath, and there's always an aftermath. Case study. The selectmen voted to approve our task force proposal of a modified van. We could park on the street overnight till the first major snowstorm. Last week, the ban was enacted after 11.5 inches of snow fell. Shopkeepers are now pitted against residents and fellow shopkeepers who parked too long in front of their stores. Gearing up again, then, in February, our task force meets to address their concerns and draft a complete revocation of the ban. A brief postmortem, voting. Only 300 of our 7,500 residents attended town meeting in 2016, which is sadly typical. The meetings are long and residents sit on aluminum chairs. The whole thing is physically debilitating and psychically draining. In most towns with town meeting form of government, there are a small handful of people, agitators, that challenge every single warrant article. The tedium is close to unbearable. But consider this. Town meeting is where the budget is set and thereby the tax rate. It's where all big issues are brought up and where many important decisions are made. In towns like Rockport, a few hundred residents decide. Communication. After the selectmen approved our proposal, I got permission to put up flyers and post post messages on Rockport's social media pages. The Times was not regularly covering Rockport events. Alas, Facebook became the main venue for information. I read Facebook notifications that said, it's about time. Civic responsibility. Nothing happens by magic. You are responsible for the quality of life in your community. While a reporter for the Portsmouth Herald, I wrote a piece about bills in Concord under consideration. My state rep, Patty Blanchett, said, If people knew how much a single phone call or letter to a legislator could impact a vote, I'd be inundated. If you're behind an issue, call me and tell me why. There are many bills I know nothing about. Her words made a lasting impression. She handed me the most precious tool to my, to my democracy I could have hoped for. She gave me my voice and told me that if I used it, I would be heard. Her lesson rings louder now than ever. Step up, speak out, start local. Many of us believe that we are on the brink of calamitous change. The environment, torture, healthcare, immigration, women's issues, and education are all on the table and subject to new laws or injurious treatment. The same voice we use to demand more compassionate parking rules is the voice we will use to demand that our immigrant neighbor be treated as our Constitution and Bill of Rights assert. There can be no recalcitrant carping from the sidelines. It's about time is passive and relinquishes control. Each one of us must pick our battles, organize our thoughts, muster our voice, and step forward. Begin in your own backyard. Plant flowers at the town dump. Pick up trash at the beach. Insist that your mayor tell you why the police chief of police lost his job. Write letters to the editor demanding coverage of your selectmen's meetings. Lobby for zoning laws that permit solar panels in historic districts. Speak up, vote, and don't quit. That's democracy in action. To sustain it, we must use it.
Good afternoon. My name's Jeff Zinn. I'm managing director at Gloucester Stage Company, and I want to invite all of you who didn't get a ticket or an invitation to the inaugural on Friday. Anybody?
I got three tickets.
You got one. Okay, good. Then you won't join us this Friday at 3 p.m.
I'm not going.
Okay. Okay. This Friday at 3 p.m. at Gloucester Stage Company, we're going to attempt to live stream the Concert for America, which I think is going to feature at least some of the artists who are not performing at the inaugural. Okay? It's free, so please come to Gloucester Stage this Friday at 3 p.m. And hopefully, if the technology cooperates, we'll have a concert. It'll be fun. So I'm gonna read two things. The first thing is by Howard Zinn, my father, and this was from his opening remarks at a debate at Johns Hopkins University, and the topic was civil disobedience. I start from the supposition that the world is topsy-turvy, that things are all wrong, that the wrong people are in jail and the wrong people are out of jail, that the wrong people are in power and the wrong people are out of power, that the wealth is distributed in this country and the world in such a way as not simply to require small reform, but to require a drastic reallocation of wealth. I start from the supposition that we don't have to say too much about this, because all we have to do is think about the state of the world today and realize that things are all upside down. Things are really topsy-turvy. As soon as you start to talk about civil disobedience, you're suggesting that the problem is civil disobedience. That's not the problem. The problem is civil obedience. What we're trying to do is get back to the principles and aims and spirit of the Declaration of Independence. This spirit is resistance to illegitimate authority and to forces that deprive people of their life and liberty and right to pursue happiness. And therefore, under these conditions, it urges the right to alter or abolish their current form of government. To establish the principles of the Declaration of Independence, we sometimes need to go outside the law. Thank you, John Lewis, who is maybe our greatest living exemplar of civil disobedience. And thank you. And now I want to read a poem by Marge Piercy, who is a wonderful, good friend of my dad's, and this was one of his favorite poems of hers. It's called The Low Road. What can they do to you? Whatever they want. They can set you up, bust you. They can break your fingers, burn your brain with electricity, blur you with drugs till you can't walk, can't remember. They can take away your children, wall up your lover. They can do anything you can't stop them doing. How can you stop them? Alone, you can fight. You can refuse. You can take whatever revenge you can, but they roll right over you. But two people fighting back to back can cut through a mob. A snake dancing fire can break a cordon. Termites can bring down a mansion. Two people can keep each other sane and give support, conviction, love, massage, hope, sex. Three people are a delegation, a cell, a wedge. With four, you can play games and start a collective. With six, you can rent a whole house, have pie for dinner with no seconds, make your own music. 13 makes a circle. 100 fill a hall. 1,000 have solidarity in your own newsletter. 10,000 community and your own papers. 100,000 a network of communities. 1,000,000 our own world. It goes one at a time. It starts when you care to act. It starts when you do it again after they say no. It starts when you say we and know who you mean. And each day you mean one more. Thank you.
I'm Elizabeth Winthrop. I'm going to read three things. The first is from Henry James' A Theory of Fiction. Life is, in fact, a battle. Evil is insolent and strong, beauty enchanting but rare, goodness very apt to be weak, folly very apt to be defiant, wickedness to carry the day, imbeciles to be in great places, people of sense in small, and mankind generally unhappy. But the world as it stands is no narrow illusion, no phantasm, no evil dream of the night. We wake up to it forever and ever, and we can neither forget it, nor deny it, nor dispense with it. This next is a poem by Maggie Smith called Good Bones. Some of you probably have heard of it. Life is short, though I keep this from my children. Life is short, and I've shortened mine in 1,000 delicious, ill-advised ways. 1,000 deliciously ill-advised ways I'll keep for my children. The world is at least 50% terrible, and that's a conservative estimate, though I keep this from my children. For every bird, there is a stone thrown at a bird. For every loved child, a child broken, bagged, sunk in a lake. Life is short, and the world is at least half terrible, and for every kind stranger, there is one who would break you, though I keep this from my children. I'm trying to sell them the world. Any decent realtor walking you through a real shithole chirps on about the good bones. This place could be beautiful, right? You could make this place beautiful. And finally, I'm going to read a poem by W.H. Auden. It's called September 1st, 1939, and it was written right as World War II was breaking out. I sit in one of the dives on 52nd Street, uncertain and afraid, as the clever hopes expire of a low, dishonest decade. Waves of anger and fear circulate over the bright and darkened lands of the earth, obsessing our private lives. The unmentionable odor of death offends the September night. Accurate scholarship can unearth the whole offense from Luther until now that has driven a culture mad. Find what occurred at Linz, what huge imago made a psychopathic god. I and the public know what all school children learn. Those to whom evil is done do evil in return.
Exiled Thucydides knew all that a speech can say about democracy and what dictators do, the elderly rubbish they talk to an apathetic grave, analyzed all in his book, The Enlightenment Driven Away, the habit-forming pain, mismanagement, and grief. We must suffer them all again. Into this neutral air where blind skyscrapers use their full height to proclaim the strength of collective man, each language pours its vain competitive excuse. But who can live for long in a euphoric dream? Out of the mirror they stare, imperialism's face and the international wrong. Faces along the bar cling to their average day. The lights must never go out. The music must always play. All the conventions conspire to make this fort assume the furniture of home. Lest we should see where we are, lost in a haunted wood, children afraid of the night who have never been happy or good. The windiest militant trash important persons shout is not so crude as our wish. What Mad Nijinsky wrote about Diaghilev is true of the normal heart. For the error bred in the bone of each woman and each man craves what it cannot have, not universal love, but to be loved alone. From the conservative dark into the ethical life, the dense commuters come, repeating their morning vow. I will be true to the wife, I'll concentrate more on my work, and helpless governors wake to resume their compulsory game. Who can release them now? Who can reach the deaf? Who can speak for the dumb? All I have is a voice to undo the folded lie, the romantic lie in the brain of the sensual man in the street, and the lie of authority whose buildings grope the sky. There is no such thing as the state, and no one exists alone. Hunger allows no choice to the citizen or the police. We must love one another or die. Defenseless under the night, our world in stupor lies. Yet, dotted everywhere, ironic points of light flash out wherever the just exchange their messages. May I, composed like them, of eros and of dust, beleaguered by the same negation and despair, show an affirming flame.
Hi, I'm Caroline Nunes, and I'm an editor of the Gloucester High School online news source, The Gilmeter, and I was put on assignment to cover this event today. So I figured I would read an original piece we are publishing next week in next week's edition. So without further ado, I'll start. In this moment, our nation is churning with political, social, and economic discontent. The opposing opinions of those who call this country home have transformed into battlegrounds, where offensive and defensive strategies used to protect our perspectives are blurred into one unidentifiable mess, that has been accredited to the influence of our free press. It is the responsibility of the press to act as a facilitator between opposing opinions. The press presents the goals of each argument and why each argument exists, usually without the intervention of personal bias. However, the nation's perception of such responsibilities has been obscured in this past election, and the increased tensions between the press and the people has created a political atmosphere teeming with discontent. But the discontent we face is only a moment in our nation's history. The United States has served as a beacon for all perspectives since its conception, and has continuously shown courage in the face of the tyranny that threatens our individualities. Like this nation, the press has also defended the viewpoints of Americans throughout our history. From Upton Sinclair's exposure of the meatpacking industry to Woodward and Bernstein's coverage of the Watergate scandal, the press has kept America in check when it fails to abide by its sacred code of justice. This nation and the press play vital roles in the defense of free speech. Without examining and telling both sides of an argument, a journalist is not abiding by his or her responsibility to give voice to the voiceless. Without acknowledging the history and personal factors behind an individual and their morals, America is not being true to its land of the free moral grounds. Yet both our nation and the press are imperfect. Both have fallen short in abiding by their codes of ethics and responsibilities. But when one falls, the other is always there to lift the other back up. Yet both our nation and the press are imperfect. Oops, sorry, I just read that. The free press is a self-sustaining security system that notifies and protects America from the injustices our founding fathers fought against. However, the press cannot do this without the protection provided by the freedoms the nation grants it. Therefore, it is vital that the free press be preserved. The press is a spark that lights a flame under the people to initiate change. Without this spark, the people cannot always identify when change is necessary in this nation. Without the spark, higher powers could suppress any attempts for change altogether. The press and our nation have shown what it takes to overcome our emotions and personal experiences that have shaped our perspectives, and to analyze another's perspective objectively. They prove that it takes even more courage to go against the restrictive social grains of this world and defend freedom of speech. Even though they sometimes fall short, the courage to defy oppressors and defend all people is not a thing of the past. So long as we remember the roots of our nation, the root of why we so often show greatness, the free press and the United States will prevail through this moment. Thank you.
Joanne, thank you so much for including me in this afternoon. To round out this part of the program, I've chosen something which I hope distills, reflects, complements, echoes a lot of what we've heard so far. I've picked this reading not aware that, Jeff, you were going to be here today. And I hope this is going to be okay. I've chosen the words of his father, Howard Zinn, an inspiring activist and teacher who wrote what I'm about to read in 1994, but actually began practicing it in 1957, when I was 6 years old, and he had his first job, full-time teaching job at Spelman College, where he accompanied his students in a sit-in in the Georgia legislature and desegregating the Atlanta library. I've picked these words because even though they were written more than 20 years ago, they still resonate today and have much to say to us, I think, about this vexing situation we are in, where truth is so often sacrificed in the interest of balance and clickbait. In my teaching, I never concealed my political views, my detestation of war and militarism, my anger at racial inequality, my belief in a democratic socialism, in a rational and just distribution of the world's wealth. I made clear my abhorrence of any kind of bullying, that's in italics here, whether by powerful nations over weaker ones, governments over their citizens, employers over employees, or by anyone on the right or the left who thinks they have a monopoly on the truth. This mixing of activism and teaching, this insistence that education cannot be neutral on the crucial issues of our time, this movement back and forth from the classroom to the struggles outside by teachers who hope their students will do the same, has always frightened the guardians of traditional education. They prefer that education simply prepare the new generation to take its proper place in the old order and not to question that order. I would always begin a course by making it clear to my students that they would be getting my point of view, but that I would try to be fair to other points of view. I encouraged my students to disagree with me. I didn't pretend to an objectivity that was neither possible nor desirable. You can't be neutral on a moving train, I would tell them. Some were baffled by this metaphor, especially if they took it literally and tried to dissect its meaning. Others immediately saw what I meant, that events are already moving in a certain deadly direction, and to be neutral means to accept that. You can't be neutral on a moving train.
That was wonderful. Thank you, all the scheduled readers. That was a fantastic program. Let's give them all a big round of applause. I can't do math. So we have just a 15 minutes to hear the five people who have signed up from the floor. And perhaps Phil's story, where are you? Phil, did you not get here today? Oh, I'm sorry. Jay Featherstone. Jay, and if you would like, you could just stand where you are and read to the, if your voice is booming enough.
Well, I'll see if the voice is booming enough.
Yeah.
Throughout his life, he opposed tyranny of the left and the right. He lived through the Nazi occupation of Poland. He lived through the communist takeover of Poland. And this poem, I think, reflects all that experience. I think it's good to remember, as you listen to what sounds like an extravagantly optimistic poem, that Milosz lived through much harder times than we are facing now. I think it's also important to listen to what the title of the poem is and think about it. The title of the poem is Incantation. Human reason is beautiful and invincible. No bars, no barbed wire, no pulping of books, no sentence of banishment can prevail against it. It establishes universal ideas in language and guides our hand so that we write truth and justice with capital letters, lie and oppression with small. It puts what should be above things as they are. Is an enemy of despair and a friend of hope. It does not know Jew from Greek or slave from master, giving us the estate of the world to manage. It saves austere and transparent phrases from the filthy discord of tortured words. It says that everything is new under the sun. It opens the congealed fist of the past. Beautiful and very young are philosophia and poetry, her ally in the service of the good. As late as yesterday, nature celebrated their birth. The news was brought to the mountains by a unicorn and an echo. Their friendship will be glorious. Their time has no limit. Their enemies have delivered themselves to destruction.
And Wendy, do you need the microphone? You can get.
I'm Wendy Fitting, and I want to give a shout out to Duncan for his the importance of listening. Also, the fact that Duncan is of an age, and I'm just about there, where we memorized poetry. So I want to give a shout out to not so much the concept of poetry, but poems. Poems that are portable, that you can carry in your pocket, that you can memorize. They're songs, really. I think, a really good model for us right now are the Freedom Riders, where white people and people of color spent hours and hours and actually months on buses together. And they labored and suffered together to understand each other. We have to be present. We have to listen. And I, for one, am going to give up any kind of temptation I might have in the future to clobber somebody with political correctness. If you've ever been scolded for using the wrong word, you know that it doesn't inspire conversation, and that's what we need. So I'm hoping that we can relearn the songs of the struggle, and we don't have to be able to read in order to sing. And we need to get on the bus with people from whom we've been divided, and perhaps people we've chastised for saying the wrong thing. And to give us a little courage for that. This is a poem by Adrienne Rich called Fantasia for Elvira Shatayev. And in her note, Rich says, Shatayev was the leader of a women's climbing team, all of whom died in a storm on Lennon Peak, August 1974. And later, Shatayev's husband found and buried their bodies. And in the poem, written in Shatayev's voice, she speaks to her husband. Can you hold that for me? The cold felt cold until our blood grew colder. Then the wind died down and we slept. If in this sleep I speak, it's with a voice no longer personal. I want to say with voices. When the wind tore our breath from us at last, we had no need of words. For months, for years, each one of us had felt her own yes growing in her, slowly forming as she stood at windows, waited for trains, mended her rucksack, combed her hair. What we were to learn was simply what we had up here as out of all words, that yes gathered its forces, fused itself, and only just in time to meet a no of no degrees, the black hole sucking the world in. I feel you climbing toward me, your cleated boot soles leaving their geometric bite colossally embossed on microscopic crystals, as when I trailed you in the Caucasus. Now I am further ahead than either of us dreamed anyone would be. I have become the white snow, packed like asphalt by the wind. The women I love, lightly flung against the mountain, that blue sky, our frozen eyes unribboned through the storm. We could have stitched that blueness together like a quilt. You come, I know this, with your love, your loss, strapped to your body, with your tape recorder, camera, ice pick, against advisement, to give us burial in the snow and in your mind. While my body lies out here, flashing like a prism into your eyes. How could you sleep? You climbed here for yourself. We climbed for ourselves. When you have buried us, told your story, ours does not end. We stream into the unfinished, the unbegun, the possible. Every cell's core of heat pulsed out of us into the thin air of the universe. The armature of rock beneath these snows, this mountain which has taken the imprint of our minds, through changes elemental and minute, as those we underwent to bring each other here, choosing ourselves, each other, and this life, whose every breath and grasp and further foothold is somewhere still enacted and continuing. In the diary I wrote, "Now we are ready, and each of us knows it. I have never loved like this. I have never seen my own forces so taken up and shared and given back. After the long training, the early sieges, we are moving almost effortlessly in our love." In the diary, as the wind began to tear at the tents over us, I wrote, "We know now we have always been in danger, down in our separateness, and now up here together. But till now," next page, "we had not touched our strength." There's a little bit of memorizing there. In the diary torn from my fingers, I had written, "What does love mean? What does it mean to survive? A cable of blue fire ropes our bodies, burning together in the snow. We will not live to settle for less. We have dreamed of this all our lives." Thank you.
Who we got? John Seavey? No. Yes. Is he here? Oh, Jim Seavey. Jim, I'm sorry. Are you here still? No? All right. Willie Alexander, you can either stand there or come on up. Yeah. Oh, you can come on. And then we're going to finish. Yeah.
This is something I wrote probably about 50 years ago. It's only 6 words. There were big letters. Wave your water, air your sky.
All right. So, actually, that's it. If Jim is really not here, he was here before. They must have had to leave. Thank you, everybody, for coming. Keep in touch. Sign up with one of for newsletters from our sponsors, the Gloucester Writers Center or Rocky Neck Cultural Center, Sea Arts, Eastern Point Lit. We'll, you know, and their newsletters and email blasts will keep you up to date on keeping together. Thank you very much.